Welcome to Stigma's Toll, a podcast series to reduce the stigma of opioid use disorder through education. I'm Eric Clemenson, a licensed alcohol and drug counselor, as well as a graduate student at the University of Minnesota in the Executive Public Health Administration and Policy Program. This podcast will discuss substance use disorder, SUD, which is a technical term for addiction. Opioid use disorder, OUD, falls under this umbrella, but is specific to those who have an addiction to opioids, such as heroin, fentanyl, or painkillers. Each episode will have a topic introduced by me, followed by an interview with an expert. Now to the episode. Safer Consumption Sites, SCS, also known as Overdose Prevention Sites, OPS, are programs where someone can use drugs that they have previously acquired in a setting with trained personnel who can react to an overdose. There has been an active overdose prevention site in Vancouver, Canada since 2003, and there are about 90 now across the world. The first two sites in the United States just opened up recently, on November 30th, 2021, in New York City. These sites are more sterile than where users may use otherwise, as well as offer clean works or injection supplies. They are helpful in reducing the spread of communicable disease, decrease mortality, and create an entry point into treatment. It appears as though the majority of people who live around these sites support them, as evidenced by a study in Ontario that shows respondents were more likely than not to agree that these sites helped reduce overdose deaths, the spread of communicable disease, provided a place to access medical services, and reduced neighborhood problems. These sites not only reduce mortality, but also save the community money. In a study regarding the estimated impact of OPS in New York City, found that one site could prevent 19 to 37 opioid overdose deaths a year, and four sites could prevent 68 to 121 deaths. These numbers appear to be conservative, as in just the first 2 weeks of the OPS in New York City being opened, there have been 25 overdoses prevented between the two locations. In Vancouver, there was a 35% reduction in mortality from overdose in the area around the OPS in the first 2 years, and there has never been an overdose death reported at one of these sites. The estimated healthcare cost saved from one site in New York City could be between $0.8 and $1.6 million, and four sites could save between $2.9 and $5.7 million annually. For this episode, we'll be talking with Amy C. Sullivan, an independent scholar and college professor. Her PhD in U.S. history from the University of Illinois at Chicago focused on women's history, children's history, and the history of medicine. Specific research interest areas include the history of drugs, alcohol, addiction, and trauma studies. Her project center life stories rooted in social change and healing through oral history, public history, and digital archives. Dr. Sullivan has been a visiting assistant professor in the history department at McAllister College in St. Paul since 2015, and has worked as an independent researcher-writer for the Bakken Museum in Minneapolis and the National Library of Medicine in Bethesda, Maryland. Dr. Sullivan literally wrote the book regarding opioid stigma in Minnesota. The book is titled Opioid Reckoning: Love, Loss, and Redemption in the Rehab State, which she wrote after working on the Minnesota Opioid Project, where she spent years traveling the globe interviewing people regarding opioid addiction. Her main focus was on Minnesota, though she did visit other areas, including Zurich, where they have had heroin-assisted treatment for years. She spoke to how this is viewed there and how it is similar to safer consumption sites. She spoke to how there is stigma regarding drug use and not wanting those people in one's backyard. Thus, opening safer consumption sites is a big challenge. Amy explained how we need to keep people alive long enough to hopefully decide to get sober, which these sites help accomplish. Now to the interview. Hi, Amy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
Good.
Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes, hi. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me here. My name is Amy Sullivan. I am a professor of history at McAllister College in St. Paul. I teach history of the United States in the modern era, which basically means the 20th and 21st century. I teach history of medicine, a history of drugs, addiction, and recovery, and the history of childhood and women's history. So I wear a lot of different hats in terms of my specialization as a historian. I'm also an oral history practitioner. So that means that I conduct for my research what we call long form interviews, which are in their entirety preserved for people in the future around topics that interest me with research. So that's what I do. And wow. I live in Minneapolis.
That's amazing. Great school. I've heard so much about McAllister. And I wish there were more classes, it sounds like, that you would be teaching about, like, modern history and everything like that, because that is so interesting and very needed. So how did you get interested in the opioid epidemic?
It's actually from a personal experience. I had a child 10 years ago. I still have her. She's still alive and thriving. Mm-hmm. Who experienced an overdose related to opioids. This came as a great shock to me as a child of the 70s and 80s, where that was just not, there was not heroin, there were not opioids on the streets. So I was completely taken aback. And because I studied the history of medicine, I started digging into what was going on. How is this even possible? And I was horrified, truly, utterly horrified, and did not understand. I also did not understand, and nor had I had any experience with the world of drug treatment, addiction treatment, or alcohol. All I knew, like everyone else, is that you just go somewhere for a month and then you come back and you're better. And boy, is that not true?
Yeah, definitely.
So far from the truth. So what I started to do as someone who studies oral history, we often look for moments where things are changing, and historians love change. We love to show where it happens, how it happened, why did it happen, why didn't it happen. And one of the people that I ended up narrating who was also one of your guests on this series is Chuck Hilger. And
yeah.
Chuck and I had lunch one day, and he said, you know, this opioid epidemic is going to change drug treatment in Minnesota. And I was like, what do you mean? He goes, the 12-step program by itself does not work.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not working and people are dying and people are going to have to get on board with more than just abstinence. And I immediately had my historian's antenna went off and I started thinking about people I had met already who might be willing to tell me their story, and that could I collect as many of these stories as possible just for the future. I wasn't really planning to write a book. I just wanted to get things documented because when I started looking into it, I saw that he was right. Mm-hmm. And some things seemed to be on the verge of change, and some places seemed to be just like digging their heels in. So that is how my collection of interviews, I came to call them the Minnesota Opioid Project. And they are about 60 of them, and they'll be housed at the University of Minnesota library that deals with social welfare history. And wow. Social issues, their social issues archive, which I'm really excited to get those in there. So that's what happened. It took on a life of its own that went way beyond my family experience. And I do feel really, really fortunate that we didn't experience the kind of tragedy that I would later encounter with my narrators. But I'm sure we can talk more about that.
Yes, of course. Definitely. Thank you so much. And yeah, Chuck Hilger, one of the leaders in medication-assisted treatment in the whole state. So that's a great person to have lunch with to kind of understand what's going on. Yeah.
The important thing about oral history that really separates it from something like journalism is that we as oral historians are preserving something, and with the idea that people in the future will be able to read and interpret and do research on those interviews in their own time and look for things that we at the time doing the interviews might not have noticed because we're living in it. And so there's really something exciting to me about a project that I'm able to use right away, but that my sources are going to be preserved so that other people can read the stories, and then people in the future can look back and say, oh, this is what happened in the 2020s or 2010s.
You had mentioned the Minnesota Opioid Project. Anything more you'd like to expand on that?
Well, the reason it became a book is I started with mothers. My original intention wasn't to make it a book. It was just to collect as many interviews as I had the energy to transcribe. And at one point, I was going to write a chapter for an edited collection about mothering. So I started my project in earnest by interviewing mothers. And I interviewed about 15 moms and about 3 or 4 dads. And that chapter, that book actually fell through. I wrote the chapter, but the book itself didn't happen. And then it was around that point that an editor from the University of Minnesota Press contacted me and said, hey, what are you doing with this opioid thing? Do you want to write a book? Let's talk. So then I started seeing my project in a way that could be of service to readers and to the public and maybe to treatment as a way to pull people's stories together for a general audience, not from this history scholar kind of mentality. And that's what we decided on, is that the Minnesota Opioid Project interviews would be available for more scholarly pursuits, but that there would be a book that pulled together the things that were important in this moment that we're currently living in. So only about 25 to 30 people are mentioned in the book, but there are about 60 in the actual archive.
Speaking of your book, I really think it is much needed information. Have you seen any stigma of addiction affect the release of your book, The Opioid Reckoning, Love, Loss, and Redemption in the Rehab State?
Isn't stigma a tricky thing? Doesn't it hide in lots of places where we can't see it?
So true.
Where people don't even realize what they're doing? Mm-hmm. I would not say the release of the book, because the press has done a phenomenal job, and I have interviewed and talking to people and had a speaking engagement in Texas. But I think one of the things that surprised me is that it's like something that is too hard to face. It's like the stigma around illegal drug use is so deeply ingrained that when people are faced with reading stories that defy their preconceived notion of who the people are who are addicted, they don't know what to do. They can't keep reading, or they just want to dismiss it. And so what I've appreciated the most are the people who say to me, I read your whole book, because I think that it takes a commitment to read this whole book. It takes a real willingness to like let your preconceived ideas and your judgments take a back seat. And that was really my goal. So I would say the stigma that I've seen is very subtle. It has to do with certain businesses maybe not wanting to have an author event, or people thinking, oh, the only people who will be interested in your book are people who've experienced opioid addiction or who have loved ones. And I'm like, no, this is not for a niche audience, for all of you, because we have gotten it wrong. We've got it wrong. We're just much too judgmental, punitive, shame oriented when it comes to drug use. And a lot of people are dying. And I think the only thing I can compare it to in my lifetime is the HIV/AIDS epidemic. And I'm sure that you have seen these as a student of public health and some of the jobs that you've been in. But that initial shock about the people who were dying, it got to a point where people were just numb to it. And I think it really wasn't until the AIDS quilt was unveiled on the mall in Washington, that kind of the enormity of the loss started to sink in, and also the realization that other people besides gay men were getting it and dying. And I think this is the exact thing that's happened with the opioid epidemic, that, oh, it was easy to just dismiss street drug users. Oh, they died. Okay, so what? You know, there's always those people. They just don't have the strength to heal. We went from that to the complete flooding of our country with prescription pain pills. And then when we get to white suburban kids dying, all of a sudden, oh my gosh, the opioid epidemic. So yeah. I think that there's real parallels. And I teach about this in my history of medicine class, that there's real parallels between the HIV/AIDS epidemic. And ironically, the people who were least served by that epidemic were injection drug users. They were the ones nobody really seen. There were very few people, there were grassroots people caring about them, and a lot of really amazing people who I've had the great fortune of meeting and reading their work. But we just don't seem to learn from the past. And I think one of the things that is so just shocking to me is that 100,000 people died in a year this past year. And that, it's like that made headlines for like a day. And I'm just, it's just heartbreaking. And I don't know. I think the reason that I feel so strongly about people reading my whole book is because we need to build our empathy muscle with people who are dying from something they don't need to die from and who are continuing to go to treatment over and over again. We would never accept this in any other illness except for mental illness and an addiction. We just would never accept it. Keep going to some treatment for cancer that doesn't do anything.
Right.
No, we don't do that. Keep taking some medicine that everybody knows doesn't work, but maybe it'll work for you. Like, we would never do that.
Of course.
So the hypocrisy of our judgment, I know where the roots are. I know how it goes back in history about morality and sin and all of that stuff. But it's just really time for us to move on. So that was a very long answer, but I loved this question. And I was so happy that you wrote it, because it's something I've been noticing, but I haven't been able to speak to. I think the stigma of addiction my book isn't going to be like a Hulu series, right? It's probably not.
Well, you never know.
Yeah, it's true. But like Dope Sick, everybody's just so like moved by that. And I get it. Mm-hmm. But what is that doing for us? What, beyond being voyeuristic to, and then, oh, the evil drug companies, right? But there's still that feeling of, oh, those poor people who are addicted, too bad they couldn't ever get help. They weren't strong enough. I feel like that narrative we need to intervene on that narrative. And I think that's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, so much so. I was going to say, working on that empathy muscle, I think you did do a great job of humanizing the people who had substance use disorder in your book, and even people who sold drugs and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And there are so many parallels between this epidemic and HIV.
Yes.
Sharing the stories and making people understand that these are real people. They're more than just that 100,000 people and everything like that.
Yes, their families
What are some exciting developments you have seen in the harm reduction field?
I'll first say that I didn't have any idea what harm reduction was when I first started this. I had to, you know, teach myself what all this meant. And to me, honestly, the idea of people, and this speaks back to my ignorance, but also my youth in the 80s and 90s, that giving people clean needles to me seemed like, wait a second, aren't you just encouraging them to keep using? I think that what I have been able to hopefully deploy in my project and in my speaking in the book is that you were not stupid because we didn't know it. Nobody taught us. There's been no education in the public about this. And hearing President Biden say the words together, harm reduction, was just, I just like squealed. because no president has ever said that. And I think we're at a real crossroads here and a real tipping point. And hopefully, my God, we should, with like nearly a million people who've died since this whole thing started. We need to. And so I would say the thing, without going into a whole long like lecture about this, I would say the thing that I feel most excited about is that people are using the word. Because when I started this 5 years ago, there were organizations that were providing Narcan who would not say the word harm reduction.
Wow.
They just wouldn't. It was very edgy. It was very pro drug user. So that changed really quickly.
Yeah.
From that point to Biden, and people just being willing to talk about what does harm reduction mean? What is it really about? And it's, you know, really about saving lives. And I would say for me, one of the most poignant things was learning that even in the hallowed halls of Hazelden, I've heard that there are families whose loved ones are leaving with Narcan and the instructions. And that in 2011, completely unheard of, never would happen. But I think they started to get the message that, and they started hearing and discovering that there were young people who were coming to their youth program who were going home using and dying because they hadn't been using in a month or you know, 2 months. So however it happens, whether it's because we hear it from Biden or we read something in the press about Narcan or needle exchange, I think the cool thing though, and again, I keep interrupting myself, but so you say the word harm reduction and you get people on board with the idea of naloxone and Narcan saving a person's life. So then the idea is, oh, so then they can go get treatment. To move from that to where we're now talking about safer consumption sites and overdose prevention sites and the way that the language is really changing around that, is so heartening to me, because what is it? What has this exposed? That there's people, there's just a group of people who use something that we don't care if they die or not.
Yeah.
And is that finally becoming unacceptable? And is it beyond a group of street outreach people who, like, whose lives are based on taking care of those very people that the rest of society scorns? And so for me to see institutions and practitioners and people being open to this, there will be a sea change, and I hope it will continue.
Yeah. And like you were speaking to, language is so important. Like you said in your book, you're talking about the term addict itself and how some people are okay with it. We're kind of moving away from that nowadays or whatnot. So yes, lots of change. And you're so right about the lack of education too. I graduated in 2012, I don't remember learning about harm reduction.
Wow. Your program was for LADC?
Correct. Yep. Yep. At one of the Minnesota schools. So that was, it's sad.
Which are on
that
the forefront of treatment. So this kind of goes to one thing I'm hoping is that we can be on the we can remain on the forefront of addiction treatment.
Definitely,
but we have to adapt and adjust and very quickly, and then say, okay, look, we can be a model because we don't have it as bad as other states.
True.
But it doesn't mean that those deaths don't hurt or inexcusable in some cases. Hopefully we can change all that. In my book, the chapter Prognosis Cloudy about Spencer Johnson, who struggled with opioids for a dozen years and it never got the right kind of treatment. His father telling me the story about trying to find a sober house for him.
Yes.
That would accept someone on Suboxone, and he could only find two in the entire metro area. And just the kind of tragic consequences of that when you learn in the book, which this is not a spoiler alert, but that Spencer passed away from a fentanyl overdose. But just that, just like, how could that just seem so cruel?
Yeah.
And it's time to quit being cruel to people who are suffering with a verifiable medical condition.
Yeah. And speaking to that is so important, because I remember working at the methadone clinic, the options were so minimal. There's treatment centers who don't allow methadone. And then, yes, even fewer sober houses out there, where homelessness really does go hand in hand with substance use disorder. So you had mentioned a little bit about safe consumption sites. How do you believe those help with substance use disorder?
First of all, I want to say I'm not an expert. This is not my field, and I have not studied this in a way that can speak to how it helps. What I learned during the course of working on my book, one of the most profound experiences I had was the opportunity to go and visit a facility, a medical center for people with addiction in Zurich, Switzerland, and interview two doctors who were affiliated with that clinic, one of whom makes it into my book. The way that the Swiss think about an addiction is so completely different from the way that we do, that their medical model incorporates not only methadone and Suboxone, but if a person isn't helped with methadone, they get prescription morphine. If they are not helped, if they can't get their life back on track, back in their job, doing all their things, they're under the care and supervision of a doctor, they will get sterile heroin. And this is mind-boggling for people in the U.S., and it blew my mind, too. But when I started thinking about what is the objective here, is the objective here to live and thrive and function as a member of the society and be a good family member, I would think that would be our goal. When I think about that later allowed me, that experience in Zurich allowed me to rethink what it means to have a safe consumption site, or as someone recently referred to them, overdose prevention site. Because what it allows is it allows those very basic things that harm reduction principles allowed, which was human contact without judgment and without expectation and with a low barrier to care, the ability to be anonymous, to get the care you need, go on your way. But in the process, you've gained a relationship with the people who work in that center or in that clinic. Really, when I think about the isolating aspects of addiction in our culture, it is what you just mentioned. It is people who have become homeless as a result of their addiction, or people who have become homeless as a result of trauma or untreated mental health issues. If we don't have places where those people who are the most marginalized can come and feel safe and know that they won't die accidentally, we're one step closer to actually getting them the help they need eventually, getting them into housing, getting them into treatment, and being able to be productive and happy members of our society again. But it's really, can we go to the place where the people are most at risk and help them? And that has the effect of helping everyone above it, right? Like that makes the parent who would have been completely aghast at the idea of having Narcan in their house more, oh, so maybe I don't kick my kid out. Maybe I say, if you're going to do this, I don't want you to, but if you're going to, I have to know so that I can keep an eye on you. Because what parent who's lost a child wouldn't agree to that?
Yeah.
They wouldn't say, oh, I'm just, yeah, no, you're terrible. So you should just go ahead and die. There's just not that many. There's just not that many. I think I also learned a huge amount about safe consumption sites from Gabor Maté and the realm of hungry ghosts. And just the idea that we need places where people are housed and safe. They're not out in the world exposed, living in places where no human being should be living. They're cared for. They have someone keeping an eye on them. And I think that's the main benefit of something like a safe consumption site. Yes, of course, they're illegal drugs. And I know all the people who get all like worked up about, oh, it's illegal. They're criminals. We're starting to come to the realization that criminalizing addiction didn't work.
Yeah.
And so if we can get to that, but if we can if society can start, you know, recognize in the mainstream that that didn't work, maybe we have space to think, okay, people are going to do this because for some reason we can't seem to stop the drugs coming into our country. Clearly, there's another person to blame, you know, or institution to blame, but people are going to keep doing it. People have been using substances for as long as we've been human. So I think accepting that and saying, okay, but let's use this space where people can do this and not die, also as a place where we can connect people to other services, they're definitely lacking. The people who are dying of overdoses are dying alone for the most part. That's another part of it too, is that it's too dangerous to have everything hidden away like that.
So true. Yeah, connection is definitely huge. And that's one of the things we've seen. We're talking about the 100,000 lives lost last year. And a lot of that was due to COVID and the lack of connection, as well as using alone because people were social distancing and everything.
Yeah.
But that's great to learn about Zurich and how, yes, all these other countries having heroin-assisted treatment.
Yeah, yeah. It's just mind-blowing considering Zurich did this in the 90s. They had what was called Needle Park, and they were like, okay, we got to stop this. They got methadone clinics. Then they started working on the problem from what they call their four pillars model. They took the whole problem and created a model for how to solve the whole problem, from the illegal drugs coming into the country to the care that people received, to the way that it was not going to be criminalized. They looked at the whole picture instead of just adding drugs as, oh, illegal. Okay, so head to the slammer. And depending on what race you are, your sentence will be different. So I think there's some progress happening in small ways, but it was, yeah, it was extremely eye-opening. Here's something you might appreciate having worked in a methadone clinic. And then I'll let you get your next question. Okay. The clinic, when I walked in, I seriously could not believe I was in an addiction clinic, a methadone clinic. I walked in and there's beautiful, sleek, black seating furniture. There were giant plants that were well cared for. There was a beautiful red wall. There was a beautiful green wall. The place was spotless. The people at the desk smiled when we walked in. There was just a feeling like, okay, I'm just a human being coming in here. It was in a downtown location. In fact, that location has now moved into an old bank building in Zurich.
Okay.
So they have this beautiful old stone building that's in the center of downtown. Like we would have a bank building here. And it just, the aesthetics of the space told me right away, oh, you matter. We care about who you are coming in here, and we want this place to look nice. The people who come here are important to us. I'm not slamming methadone clinics, but I haven't been in a single one where I could say that same feeling I had going in the door.
Yes. I do remember you speaking to that some in the book. When we think of methadone clinics here, there is that line outside, which you had mentioned in the book.
Beige.
Yes.
Crappy furniture. You know, and I'm not slamming anybody here specifically. So if you, if someone listening gets their feelings hurt, it's not about the specific places as much as it is an overall attitude about what kinds of spaces we care for people in.
Definitely.
And you think about brand new cancer centers and what they look like and how cared for and loved people are made to feel, how people are believing in them to get through this. And you feel that when you come into those spaces, and it's just, there's nothing like that.
So true. And that just continues to speak to the stigma of SUD and everything like that. So I know you spoke a little bit about parents and their thoughts of safer consumption sites. Have you seen any other, or have you heard of any other stigma affecting safer consumption sites?
People don't want them in their neighborhoods. I read an article in the New York Times recently about one in New York, and there's a lot of people who live in the neighborhood who don't want it there. And I don't know what's going to happen because Minneapolis is now talking about having one. This is really a PR thing. It's really about investing in communities too. Things are so unequal, and there's so many pockets of cities where people aren't living in conditions that are caring and adequate. That's where drug users are going to congregate. And so for me, the idea would be about incorporating more than just the site, more than just that one thing that sounds, you know, really difficult. When I think about stories I've heard of how hard it is to get group housing for people with mental health issues, or even sober houses, having that be a problem, or domestic violence shelters, like that the people that need our help the most are the ones, there doesn't seem to be a care about where those people end up. And oh no, can't be in my neighborhood because you know, of my tax base, or I don't want criminals in my neighborhood. We need to reframe how we think about spaces, I think, and how we care for all of our communities. So I'm sure, yes, there would be increased drug use in those places, but maybe there won't be people dying in public bathrooms when the door is locked, or people mm-hmm. dying in the alleyway and nobody finding their body for 24 hours. Maybe there'll be less of that, and those drug dealers will move on, or the criminal behavior will abate. Maybe violence will go down. I don't know. I think we're at such a new, it's such a new idea that it's going to take a real savvy kind of community marketing mm-hmm. education. It's a huge task. Those people have a lot of work ahead of them, but anything I can do to speak out and support it, I will.
That's great.
I think there's benefits to it, and we need to get away from that NIMBY mentality.
Very much so. Yeah, I was going to mention definitely the not in my backyard. And it is a PR thing. You're very right there. Because speaking to neighbors not wanting one of the safer consumption sites, mm-hmm. same thing happened in Philadelphia, where they tried to open one in March of 2020. And there was such an outrage from all the neighbors that they actually delayed it. And then, of mm-hmm. course, COVID hit, so it hasn't opened up. Definitely a PR. Yeah. And going back to the wording too, that'd probably be pretty important too.
There's also the other aspect of it is like so much of harm reduction services have been underground and grassroots. Mm. What's happened is that the need for them has increased tenfold because of the epidemic and fentanyl. When are we going to realize, okay, we have to change how we're doing this so that people don't die? Where are places where we say, okay, it's all right for people to be here and consume safely and know that they're not going to die of an overdose? Where are those spaces? Are those health clinics? Do they look like medical clinics? I think there's just a lot of conversation that needs to happen around them, but they also have to be where people are using, which mm-hmm. is really a hard shift to make. Because those places have been so siloed, they've been marginalized and in such disrepair. When people think of, oh, people who use drugs only use them in those places, it's ironic because it's probably like the smallest number of people actually using than mm-hmm. if you looked at where people are using, it's all over the metro area, all over mm-hmm. the state of Minnesota.
It's everywhere. You know,
from rural to urban. Yeah.
And yeah, definitely. Yeah. The more conversations, the better. And just going back to the dead people don't recover. So it's all about keeping people alive long enough to then recover and hopefully stop at some point. I know you've mentioned quite a bit about stigma, but I was wondering if there's anything else you'd like to add about stigma and opioid use disorder specifically?
I think in Minnesota, it's been very eye-opening because we are home to the Minnesota model that is abstinence-based and based in moving through the 12 steps up to like step 4 and then leaving after 28 days and just going to a bunch of meetings mm-hmm. and staying abstinent. I think that what has happened is opioids have been deeply stigmatized for a really long time in that system. What I understood, and even within the treatment world, when I first encountered methadone and methadone clinics and who they were for, there was a really clear message that methadone mm-hmm. was for the people who didn't have the moral and spiritual strength to not use. Mm. And this was heartbreaking to me because I just don't think that's true. First of all, it's where I really started to question mm-hmm. like what is going on here, that there's certain people that get the medicine but that medicine is bad because they're weak people. So troubling to me. What I noticed is that the Minnesota model and that mentality has perpetuated itself throughout all of our systems of care. Mm-hmm. Like doctors don't have to talk to people about medication for opioid use disorder. They just tell the patient to go to treatment. They don't have to learn about it. One of my narrators, Bob Levy, who you probably remember in the mm-hmm. doctor's chapter, who himself had an addiction to fentanyl, he says that his goal is trying to treat addiction through primary care as a primary care physician. So the rules have been relaxed. This is one example of how stigma prevents this from ending. Mm-hmm. So the rules on Suboxone for healthcare providers have been significantly relaxed so that they can have many more hundreds of patients on it, their amount of interaction with the DEA, because it's a controlled substance, has been minimized. And he goes person to person around to talk to different primary care physicians, admits to them and says, you know my story. So I'm here because I want to talk to you about getting Suboxone. You should be a provider. Like, no, I don't want to work with those people.
Mm-hmm.
In his face, they say those people. But are they not seeing him? This is where I'm like, wait, where did the stigma go? Somehow it's not on him, but it goes to them quickly when he's the one sitting here saying, right? So it's, when I think about it, I think of it as this just extremely tricky thing, like the trickster character in like folklore and stuff. Like it's always changing shape or shape shifting. So that example is really profound, because if you can't get doctors in primary care to talk to patients about their opioid use, instead what they're doing is being so afraid they won't give anyone. They're being so afraid of getting in trouble now because of the prescribing, because they clamp down on the prescribing. They don't want to give it. And here's something you may or may not know, but the same thing happens with the Harrison Narcotic Act in the teens. I think it's 1914. So then that was also blaming doctors for giving people morphine, which morphine was helping people, but people got addicted. And so they took it out against the doctors. And then all you have all these poor people who are withdrawing from morphine. So we just want to intervene on only one part of the problem and say we've solved something, instead of like, okay, wait, let's look at all the places where there's stigma and what are all the barriers that those various kinds of stigma place on us. Yeah. No, I think there's so many examples. I could talk your ear off about the stigma that I saw. But really, when I think about it, that was the thing that stood out to me so deeply. And I thought, okay, well, what's the opposite? What's the opposite of stigma? It's empathy.
Yeah.
Because it only takes dissecting it, saying, okay, this is stigmatizing. Do you see how this is stigmatizing? Okay, so now what am I supposed to do? Now we would want you to not exclude that person or dismiss them, which is what stigma does. And we want you to see that person as a fellow human being, see that person as someone you can help and care for, even if they stumble, even if they slip, even if they return to use. It's not nice, right? How we're treating people in so many ways. And the thing is, there's so many wonderful people in the treatment industry, so many lovely, beautiful, smart, creative people. And I think we need to garner that kind of energy, and let's pull all that together and look honestly at where things have failed and be honest about being able to say, okay, you know what? This is not working this way. And I did encounter many people who face those things and who are changing treatment and changing the way they run their practice as a result of that. Empathy and listening to each other's stories, I think, is one way to dissipate stigma, because you just can't think differently about it after you hear the doctor. Of those six doctors in that chapter, I think four of them had an opioid use disorder. So that's shocking. People are like, what?
Yeah. It's not who you think of.
Of course. And that's the whole story, isn't it? Expand the characters and know that so many people struggle with addiction.
Definitely. So true. And yeah, the more stories out there about these doctors and about the people who you wouldn't, you know, expect or whatnot, the more we really could build that empathy. And speaking to the other types of modalities and everything, like the Minnesota Alternatives that you spoke to in the book, just changing really everything of how we work with people who have substance use disorder.
Yes, yes. Paula, she goes by Paula Brandt now, her married name. She was the founder of Minnesota Alternatives. She is now breaking new ground in mental health and addiction treatment with a new clinic that's going to be using very alternative modalities, which is like some of the microdosing with psilocybin and ketamine. And I think there are groundbreaking things happening in places like Johns Hopkins and Stanford, Columbia, where we're going to learn that there are ways to treat addiction that we haven't yet learned. And I'm really excited about that. The people who are on the edges there, who are like pushing us to think in new ways and studying.
Yeah, so much so. The more studying, the better. Talking with Dr. Mark, he talked about some of the stigma affecting the funding and things like that. And
Mark Thomas, is that who you're talking about? Yeah, I'm sure he knows that well. Anyone who works in this field knows stigma well.
Unfortunately, that is very, very true.
Even in families, I think that's another aspect where families deal with this and try to hide it or try to tell their other family members they don't get it or they think they know what to do. I think the silence around it and the kind of shame based in it, and then add to that the anonymity factor that 12-step and AA really solidified in our culture, it makes it really hard for people to hear these stories. And I think that was one of the things I was so grateful to my narrators. So are you okay with me writing this in the book? Yes, yes, keep it like this. Just that generosity of spirit to share your story, because it's done in the service of helping other people. I think that is another way to think about recovery and breaking down stigma. Is like, the more of us that talk about it, the less stigmatizing it is. Yeah.
So true. So true. Going back to the gay movement, the whole come out of the closet, wherever you are and things like that.
Yes.
It's hard to other people when you actually know somebody and you're close to them who has whatever someone might be discriminating against or have some stigma against and everything. So
there's definitely parallels with the LGBT community and drug addiction. You're absolutely right. Well, and I think that's also where language becomes incredibly important, is how we speak about things. There's so much to be learned from the past and from other groups of people who've learned to speak out. And when people are treated one way and spoken to in certain ways and told that they have to hide who they are, it doesn't work out. And what I find so heartening about the students that I teach today is that they're so on board with harm reduction. They're so on board with destroying the gender binary. They're just like, bring it, you know? To me, it sort of feels like a 1960s flower child kind of situation again, because it's like, no, we need to take care of each other. We need to love each other for who we are. I know I'm starting to sound like a flower child now, but it's really heartening. And I really see change happening in large part because of young people. And what they're willing to accept and what they won't accept from closed-minded, punitive institutions.
Definitely, yes. I can definitely see that we are moving in the right direction as it seems with Generation Z and everything. So what are your hopes for the future of harm reduction?
I just hope that it becomes incorporated and it's how we care for each other in all ways. The thing I like to say when I first start talking about harm reduction sometimes is that, yeah, seatbelt is harm reduction. And people were really against seatbelts, but guess how many lives have been saved?
Yeah.
And that just thinking about it also as a movement that's really based in love and love for other people, whether you are related to them or not, that you're acting out of respect for fellow human beings who are on this planet with us and who are suffering. So I think about it in a very philosophical way a lot. I think that helps me not get bogged down in the slow bureaucratic movement towards things or the like flash in the pan kind of headlines. I want to try to think of it in a more broad way as something that we incorporate. And, you know, just my final thing I wanted to bring up, because I've talked about all three of these things, the Minnesota model as one, and then medication as another one that emerged in the 1960s. And then harm reduction, which comes around in the late 80s. We really need to move back and forth between these, because each one of those has something really powerful to offer in terms of ending the opioid epidemic. 12-step programs create community. They create support. They create a whole new social setting, if you want it. They help people get in touch with themselves. Medication stabilizes a person so they can figure out what do they want to really want to do with their lives. And then harm reduction keeps people from dying, right? And so to me, those three things which have been siloed from each other and almost contentious with each other really need to be integrated. So, you know, you asked what's your hope for harm reduction, I would say it's a hope that all those things come together to reduce the harm and to reduce the death rate.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You put that very eloquently.
Thank you.
I like that idea. They are so siloed and they don't need to be. Any other like last words or anything that you might want to share with the audience?
I'm just hoping that in 10 years, we can look back and say that we solved the opioid epidemic in the 2020s. I hope we can look back the way we look at the HIV AIDS epidemic and say, oh, there's medicine for that. you don't have to die from this anymore. That's what I really hope. So I hope my book becomes a history in my lifetime.
Yes, exactly. Not a continuation
then it
or
becomes
whatnot.
History quickly. I don't want to be here a year from now talking about the next 100,000 people who died. I think we have a moment and we can move on it. So I hope that we do.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure chatting with you, Eric.
Yes, you as well.
Thanks
of course.
For inviting me.
Of course.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Stigma's Toll. All references will be available in the episode description. Please share this podcast series with anyone who you believe may be interested. Please feel free to send me a message either on my anchor.fm profile page or through the link in the description. Please stay tuned for the next episode.